Now we'll begin the summing up for the semester. Last time we ended with the death of Josiah in battle against Berenice. I'd just like to reread that passage. This time I'm reading from the New Jewish Translation. In 2 Chronicles chapter 35, in the New Jewish Translation anyway, it's verse 20. After all this furbishing of the temple by Josiah, King Necho of Egypt came up to fight at Carchemish on the Euphrates, and Josiah went out against him. Necho sent messengers to him, saying, "What have I to do with you, King of Judah? I do not march against you this day, but against the kingdom that wars with me. And it is God's will that I heard. Refrain then from interfering with God, who is with me, that he not destroy you." That Josiah would not let him alone. Instead, he donned his armor to fight him, heedless of Necho's words from the mouth of God. And he came to fight in the plain of Megiddo. Archer shot King Josiah, and the king said to his servants, "Get me away from here, for I'm badly wounded." His servants carried him out of his chariot and put him in the wagon of his second in command and conveyed him to Jerusalem. So he died and was buried in the grave of his fathers, and all Judah and Jerusalem went into mourning over Josiah. Jeremiah composed laments for Josiah with all the singers, male and female, recited in their laments for Josiah as is done to this day. They became customary in Israel and were incorporated into the laments. And so Josiah's reign, which was a very glorious one, because it was the reign of a man who truly sought after God with his whole heart, and a man who thereby accomplished probably the most thoroughgoing reform, religious reform, that Judah ever experienced since the days of initial apostasy in the days of Solomon. Sure, there were revivals at other times under King Asa, for example, under King Jehoshaphat, another good king, and certainly under King Hezekiah. But the one in the days of Josiah was the most thorough, and after Josiah's reign, nothing remained of either the pagan high places or the Yahwistic high places anywhere in Judah. And also remember, Josiah was able to carry out that reform even in the northern kingdom because of the weakness of Assyria. And that's why, you might say, it even added to the thoroughness of that reform. Now, something very interesting happened with the death of Josiah. We study the family tree of Josiah. We have Josiah, and the Bible records that at his death, Josiah left three sons. The oldest name was Eliakim. The second son's name was Jehoahaz. And the third son's name was Mattaniah. All three would eventually rule as king of Judah. But what is interesting is the order in which they were to rule. The first of Josiah's sons to rule was not the oldest Eliakim, but the second oldest, Jehoahaz. Now, you can't pick this up from the scripture that easily because it doesn't go out of its way to point it out. The way you pick it up from the scripture is when Jehoahaz became king, it says he was 23 years old. And he reigned for 3 months. Whereupon, the king of Egypt deposed him and laid a fine on the land of 100 silver talents and 1 gold talent. And then the king of Egypt made his brother Eliakim king over Judah and Jerusalem. And it mentions that he was 25 years old when he began to reign. So as I say, if you look at it carefully, you can see that if there's only 3 months to separate when Jehoahaz became king and when Eliakim became king, and Jehoahaz was 23 and Eliakim was 25, that Jehoahaz was not the oldest son. So we have something a bit strange that took place, which is partially explained in 2 Chronicles 36. It says, "The people of the land took Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, and made him king instead of his father in Jerusalem. Now normally when a king dies, it just says, so-and-so died and was buried with his fathers in the city of David, and so-and-so, his son, reigned in his stead. In other words, it was a normal succession. So this tells us this was not a normal succession. The people of the land made a decision and preferred the second son, Jehoahaz, over his older brother. Now the Bible doesn't tell us why. The Bible does not tell us why that choice was made. We are left only perhaps to speculate. Perhaps Eliakim counseled in the wake of his father's death that they make peace with Pharaoh Necho. And Jehoahaz might have belonged to a party that was pro-Babylonian and wanted to follow the policy of his father Josiah. And that policy was more in favor, so they chose Jehoahaz, his father. Since 3 months later, in other words, after Pharaoh Necho had fought the Battle of Carchemish and had stopped the Babylonians at the Euphrates, he couldn't save the Assyrians. The Assyrians were crushed.
Totally disappeared from the face of history as far as we know it. They didn't really disappear. We know that, but as far as history knows, they disappeared. And Babylon, however, was stopped at the Euphrates and could not proceed westward because of Pharaoh Necho's work.
Now we know 3 months later he removed Jehoahaz and put his older brother in his place. There must have been some reason why Necho did not like Jehoahaz and chose instead to remove him and put his brother in his place. And so it wouldn't be a far-out speculation that Jehoahaz had followed a pro-Babylonian policy and Eliakim either been neutral or had followed a pro-Egyptian policy. And this is a reasonable speculation. So Jehoahaz reigns first, and he only reigns for 3 months. Then the older brother, Eliakim, is put on the throne. Do you remember King Eliakim of Judah? His name ring a bell? How many of you say his name's a bell? Let me see your hands. King Eliakim of Judah. Well, it shouldn't, because there is no such person in the Bible. At least not as a king. You see, Pharaoh Necho not only laid a fine on Judah, probably because of Josiah's actions and Jehoahaz's continuation in that policy, but the king of Egypt made his brother Eliakim king over Judah and Jerusalem and changed his name. He changed his name to Jehoiakim. Now, why in the world would the Pharaoh change the name of Eliakim to Jehoiakim? Well, in those days, that was not such an unusual policy, especially of the Egyptians. To change a vassal's name. Think of the symbolism that a man is ruling over his own people, but he has to recognize, of course, an overlord over him. What does the name change by the overlord signify? I mean, how does that sort of strengthen the relationship? I mean, here's a man who claims to be king of his own country and he can't even control what his own name is. You have to understand in the ancient world what a name meant. He who possessed a name had power over the individual. That was their folk mythology, if you will. For instance, the pharaohs of Egypt are known to us by at least two of their names. Every pharaoh has three names. Two of them are generally known from inscriptions. One is the common name that we read about in history, like Thutmose III, or Amenhotep II, or Seti, or Ramses II. But each of them had another name, which was their, you might say, name as a son of the sun god. Nerenkara is another one of those names of one of these pharaohs. I think it was Ramses II. I'm not positive that point. It might be somebody else. But each of the pharaohs also had a secret third name. Why a secret third name? Because that way nobody through magic could
could gain control of him by repeating his name. Using a magical incantation, you get control over the person by repeating their name. That was their belief. But since he had this third secret name, you know, nobody would have total control over him. They could only acquire knowledge of two of his names. That's why the Egyptians particularly liked to change the names of their vassals. Because that meant that they had power over them. They had power over them because they controlled the name of that individual. This is why the Jews, rather superstitiously, because they were aware of this folk mythology, refused to pronounce the real name of God. Because they felt it was blasphemous to try to indicate that you could control God by pronouncing his name, you know, and linking it with various prayers and so on. And so, rather than use his name, they used Adonai, Lord. And so finally, the tradition forgot what the name was. Forgot what the name was, and nobody to this day knows what it really was. There was a folk tale of the Middle Ages. Well, wait a minute. I don't know. No, I'm sorry. It wasn't a folk tale written in the Middle Ages. Sorry about that. It was written in the 19th century, so early 20th century. About a marvelous wonder worker of the Middle Ages, in Prague. And this person had discovered the missing or lost name of God. He made an enormous statue bigger than the, what's his name? The Green Monster. No. Cartoon characters, you know, on a television. The Incredible Hulk, right. Bigger than the Incredible Hulk. He made it out of clay. He made it out of clay to protect the Jews of Prague against their enemies, who frequently used to break into the ghetto and vandalize and rape women and steal things and so on. He built it, but of course it was just a hunk of clay. But because he had discovered the missing name of God, he wrote it out and put the paper and put it in this thing's mouth, and it came alive. But again, it's that folk mystique that if you have the ability to invoke God's name, you can do miracles with it. You have access to the power of God, and you can use it as you want. That's what that folk story commemorates. An ancient idea that comes out of the Middle East, that you acquire power over an individual by acquiring their name, even if it is a god whose name you acquire power over. So, this is the symbolism that lies behind the name change, is that this person is totally enthralled to his overlord. Well, Jehoiakim ruled for a while, but he was not a very faithful servant, as we read. Says he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem, and he did what was displeasing to the Eternal as God. And then, you see, we have to understand what's happening here. We start off under Josiah, where we have an independent Judah. Then we have the successor, Jehoahaz, looks like that, who is also king of an independent Jew. Then we have Eliakim, or to use the name we more readily associated with him, Jehoiakim, who is a vassal of Egypt. That lasts for a short number of years. The Battle of Carchemish was fought in 609 B.C., that's the death of Josiah. Jehoahaz immediately became king, and 3 months later he was deposed, and Jehoiakim became king. So Jehoiakim is a vassal of Egypt from 609 to 605 B.C., about 4 years, or a little less than 4 years.
Then, as it says in the scripture, that King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon marched against him, and bound him in fetters to convey him to Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar also brought some vessels of the house of the Eternal to Babylon, and set them in his palace in Babylon. Then it says the other events of Jehoiakim's reign and the abominable things he did and what was found against him are recorded in the book of the kings of Israel and Judah. His son Jehoiachin succeeded him as the king. And so we now have the son of Jehoiakim. His name is Jehoiachin. He is now a vassal of the king of Babylon. Jehoiachin was 8 years old when he became king. He reigned 3 months and 10 days in Jerusalem. He did that which was displeasing to the Eternal. At the turn of the year, King Nebuchadnezzar sent to have him brought to Babylon with the precious vessels of the house of the Eternal, and he made his kinsman Zedekiah king over Judah and Jerusalem. Now, who in the world is Zedekiah? Where do we find him? Let's take a look at the companion scriptures in 2 Kings, and we will find more readily how this links up. I have to do more flipping than you, because I've left this New Jewish translation. 2 Chronicles is the last book of the Bible in that version. Okay. We pick up the story and find out what happened even to Jehoahaz. In 2 Kings chapter 23, verse 31, Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he became king. He reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. He did that which was displeasing to the Eternal, as his fathers had done. Pharaoh Necho imprisoned him in Riblah, in the region of Hamath, to keep him from reigning in Jerusalem. And then Pharaoh Necho appointed Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in place of his father Josiah, and changed his name to Jehoiakim. He took Jehoahaz and brought him to Egypt, where he died. Now, Jehoiakim, of course, becomes a vassal to Egypt. And then we find verse chapter 24, 2 Kings 24. In his days, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came up, and Jehoiakim became his vassal for 3 years. Then he turned and rebelled against him. And so, you see, Jehoiakim himself is also a vassal of the king of Babylon. He starts off as a vassal of Egypt, and then he becomes a vassal of Babylon, and then in 605 he rebels, and he is carried away. And Jehoiachin, it says he was 18 years old when he became king. This is one of those places where we have a discrepancy between these two accounts. It seems that 18 was the correct number. Verse 8 of chapter 2 Kings 24. It appears that just the number 10 has dropped out of the text in Chronicles. And Nebuchadnezzar besieged the city. King Jehoiachin, along with his mother, his courtiers, his commanders and officers, surrendered to the king of Babylon. The king of Babylon took him captive in the 8th year of his reign. He carried off from Jerusalem all the treasures of the house of the Eternal and the treasures of the royal palace. He stripped off all the golden decorations in the temple of the Eternal, which King Solomon of Israel had made, as the Eternal had warned. He exiled all of Jerusalem, all the commanders and warriors, 10,000 exiles, as well as the craftsmen and smiths. Only the poorest people in the land were left. Now, when is this removal? When does this happen?
This happened in 597 B.C. 597 B.C., Jehoiachin goes into captivity with the leading classes of Judah and Jerusalem, and in addition to them, notice it specifies craftsmen and smiths. Nebuchadnezzar was in the process of beautifying Babylon. He was on the lookout for talented artisans, and so he scooped up a bunch of them from Judah to take to Babylon to put to good use. So let's review what we've got. 609, Jehoahaz is removed. He's removed in 609 by Pharaoh Necho. Jehoiakim becomes the vassal of Egypt in 609. And then at a time not specified in the text,
We have, I made a mistake here, I put 609 to 605, that's my fault. In the time not specified in the text, we have Jehoiakim becoming the vassal of Babylon. And then in 605, Jehoiakim is removed, Jehoiachin becomes his replacement. Jehoiachin is removed in 597 B.C. for his rebellion against Nebuchadnezzar, and his uncle, Mattaniah, has his name changed to Zedekiah and becomes the last king of Judah. As we know that in 586, Jerusalem fell for the last time to the Babylonians.
We have the same policy as the policy of the Assyrians. You make somebody a vassal, he rebels, you remove him and put somebody else in his place. They rebel a second time, you begin deporting people. They rebel a next time, you then deport almost everybody and independent national existence comes to an end. Same policy as the Assyrians being used here with Judah. And so this brings the independence of the people of Judah to an end. We find the end of chapter 2 Kings 25, the destruction of the temple, which Jeremiah had prophesied of. And we find that like the Assyrians, some people were left. Notice in 2 Kings 25, verse 22. 2 Kings 25, verse 22. King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon put Gedaliah, the son of Akikam, son of Shaphan, in charge of the people whom he left in the land of Judah. There were some who were left, just like the Assyrians left some in the north. Gedaliah was in charge of them. And of course, Gedaliah was soon assassinated. And then when the Babylonians began to threaten to retaliate, the people that had assassinated Gedaliah left Judah and went down into Egypt, dragging Jeremiah along with them. And of course, I think you're aware of Jeremiah traveling with his scribe Baruch and with at least one of the princesses of the royal house, one of the daughters of Zedekiah, whom he eventually married to Prince Haraman in Ireland. So this marks the end of the independence of Judah. So what do we see when we review the last years of Judah? We see several things. We see that several different kings occupied the throne in a very small span of years. We're talking about 23 years, and we have four different kings in 23 years, from 609 to 586. We find first servitude to Egypt, and then servitude to Babylon. We find a series of rebellions against Babylonian rule, and the Babylonians, using the policies of the Assyrians, treat the Jews just as the Assyrians had treated the people of the north, first reducing them in size, and finally exiling them almost totally, leaving only the poorest people of the land behind. So this ends our semester's work, and we will entertain some questions.